And we're back in a somewhat professional setting.
Oh my God, look at us.
We got like microphones now and I can only see your nose up. Just stare across the table.
Like, it's getting kind of creepy already.
Welcome back to Mike, and Oscar. We are here. We're in the throes of award season. A lot of the film critic associations have given out their awards and have started handing out the hardware. Golden Globe nominations just came out. Critics' Choice nominations are out. That award show coming up at the end of the month.
I feel like firing a starter pistol because we're getting ready to sprint.
That's right. And that's what we're on to fill you guys in on. We've teased it for a little bit now. And you heard it at the end of the Golden Globes pod, which was our last episode. We are going to be doing what we like to call Oscar sprint episodes. And what those are going to pretty much be self-contained. They're not going to be as long as our retrospectives. Hopefully 45 minutes, an hour, maybe a little longer on the contender movies. Basically, we want to go deep dives into all the big movie profiles. We're going to give you the specs of the movies like we always do. The biographies of the people involved, how these movies basically got made from soup to nuts. And then we're going to delve into their awards, what chances they have, what you can expect if you go to see them, because that's ultimately what we're trying to do for you, let you know which of these awards, these contenders are worth seeing and are worth your time. And then, you know, we're going to break it down for you. We're going to try to get you as ready as we can for Oscar night itself. We're hoping to have all these done prior to the Academy Award nominations coming out.
Yes, that's going to be in January, and we're hoping to get all of the contender pods done before then, all of the Oscar sprint pods done before then. I think it's more accessible to all you folks. I think it's more user-friendly. You can navigate spoilers pretty easy. We're going to have a spoiler section with some crazy, wacky music that should give you 15 seconds of warning before we dive into spoilers. And, you know, we're going to stick to our guns, what we've been doing up till now with the Mike, and Oscar reviews. We're going to give you that deep dive, but we're going to be even more thorough, and we're going to kind of attack the non-spoiler section with a look at the technical aspects and the performances, and we're going to attack the spoiler section with kind of an overall look at how the story is pulled off, the directing, and the overall composition of the film, which we can really, you know, analyze the spoiler parts of the movie. So
yeah, we've said it to you guys before. We don't have special screeners. We don't see advanced copies of stuff. We see the movies, and we like seeing the movies as they're accessible to you guys, the audience, the fans. And with that, you know, as the bigger movies come out, the ones that aren't out yet, for example, this episode, The Disaster Artist, just recently came out. We're going to be on top of The Post. We're going to be on top of Star Wars. Those bigger ones.
Yes.
As those come, we're going to try to release those closer to their release dates. There's going to be older movies that we've kind of already gone over, such as Get Out, which will be an episode. Lady Bird's already passed. Those obviously won't be close to their release dates, but we're going to give you a glimpse at every movie. It's going to be its own self-contained program, and this is the first one. We're covering The Disaster Artist, the James Franco passion project, I guess you'd call it. It is
quite the passionate movie.
It was passion, yeah. There was certainly passion. Surprisingly funny movie, but this is it. This is the Oscar sprint profile of The Disaster Artist, and Mike will lead you off, as he always does, giving you a run-up to the, what do you call it? Biographies?
I'm going to give you a production
production profile.
Yeah, Mike never reads my titles.
I don't know.
They
how
don't
to
have
read.
Puns in them. He doesn't want to.
So Mike's going to give you the production profile, and he'll start us off, and we'll get going. Like Mike said, this, like every episode of an Oscar sprint that we do, will be a spoiler-full episode. Just be warned. We're going to give you a warning when the spoilers hit, but there is going to be a time where you will hear spoilers pertaining to these movies. We'll give you a warning. We'll put something on the air. You'll be able to hear it and point it out. We'll put it in the show notes. Just want to give you guys that heads up. But for right now, let's do a production profile for The Disaster Artist. Michael.
So yeah, we'll stay spoiler-free until the end. Story inception material here. The Disaster Artist was adapted from a book by Greg Sestero and Tom Bissell.
It was raised by a snake charmer.
it was written about the making of the cult classic The Room, which was a film that has been called the Citizen Kane of bad movies. Now, I'm about two-thirds of the way
into... That's like me and Mike being cute for fat guys.
Now, how am I going to get over that joke? The book, I'm about two-thirds through the audiobook listening right now.
God help you.
It has sold me from the jump because it's... And Mike, you'll love this. It's quoting either Sunset Boulevard,
nice,
or The Talented Mr. Ripley, which I can either take or leave. It's okay, but it's quoting the Sunset Boulevard at the beginning of every chapter, and it's like Greg Sestero is Joe Gillis, William Holden, and
Gloria Swanson is rolling over in her grave.
Is the Tommy Wiseau character? Oh, so
good lord,
The Room premiered in 2003. It starred and was written, directed, and produced by Tommy Wiseau, who is now being played by James Franco in The Disaster Artist. But The Disaster Artist is about the making of The Room. Both the book and James Franco's movie is about the making of The Room. So this could get a little
How meta can we get
confusing here?
Yeah.
The Room co-starred Greg Sestero, who was a male model in San Francisco out of high school.
But why male models?
Having gasoline fights at the it's ridiculous, super duper ridiculous.
We make these jokes because we're not models.
No,
we're just angry at their good looks.
And he played the Mark in Oh Hi Mark,
beautiful
in the movie.
Mwah.
So Dave Franco plays Tommy Wiseau. Greg Sestero is played by his brother. If I can not do the Porky Pig accent there, is played by his brother, Dave Franco.
I was wondering why you weren't wearing pants today.
Greg is played by Dave Franco. And Greg Sestero, a.k.a. the Dave Franco character, wrote the book. So hopefully that cues you in. I'm going to have Mike now read the premise.
Oh, boy.
Like the dancing monkey you are. Read the premise of The Room.
So this is straight off the IMDb page of The Room, which oddly enough says it debuted in Australia first. Take that for what it's worth.
I don't know if that's true.
Johnny is a successful banker who lives happily in a San Francisco townhouse with his fiancée, Lisa. One day, inexplicably, she gets bored with him and decides to seduce his best friend, Mark. From there, nothing will be the same again.
I love a plot premise with the transition of one day
boredom.
Inexplicably.
Just boredom. Straight boredom.
Yeah.
This movie's not misogynistic.
One day inexplicably. Oh, no. This movie is easily the most misogynistic movie I've ever seen, but it's so offensive that it's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's the charm in it, right? I mean, it's like,
that's not just
so
me saying
awful.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, a lot of the women who are crazy fans, and obviously.
God bless them, too.
Followers. Now, the movie's tagline is, "Can you really trust anyone?" The posters for the movie.
This is The Room's tagline.
This is The Room's tagline. The Room's tagline is, "Can you really trust anyone?" It was, at the time, marketed as like this Tennessee Williams level drama. On the billboards. Now, Tommy Wiseau bought a billboard for 6 years, which must be hundreds of thousands of dollars, everybody has estimated, in California in this profile spot.
And like in the middle of LA. Like it was outside, right outside Jimmy Kimmel's offices, he said on one of his programs, which is right in the heart of Hollywood.
It was there. And obviously, you have the picture of Tommy Wiseau, hair pulled back, looking kind of down, the camera's tilted at him. Not smiling.
It's the greatest headshot in Hollywood history.
Lazy eye.
Yeah.
The poor guy has a lazy eye. But in all of his glory. And
this is not us being, like, we're not taking pot shots.
No.
This is just how it is. One eye is up and one eye is straight. And more power to Tommy for putting this out there.
So another podcast about bad movies. How did this get made on iTunes? It's a funny podcast. It's done by.
Ironically. Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas.
And it's also done by June Diane Raphael. All three of those actors, comedians, were in The Disaster Artist. And they said that it should have been called Meth Bender. If the title of the if the title of The Room was actually called Meth Bender, everybody would have went to see it. Now, here's the crazy thing. And Seth Rogen in a
Here's
bunch
the
of,
crazy thing?
In a bunch of the Seth Rogen interviews, I watched a lot of the promotional stuff. We got snowed in this weekend, folks. So I've just like been trapped in the room all weekend. Seth Rogen often jokes that there was a phone number atop this billboard.
Another thing Franco talked about in his Jimmy Kimmel interview about this movie on his press junket.
Apparently, the phone number went directly to Tommy Wiseau's.
We're not dealing
apartment.
With a human, guys. This is not a human being. This is a man that operates on whatever level it is. It's a different one than most humans operate on.
Now, like I said, I'm almost through the audiobook right now, and I was really excited to watch how...
I was disheartened to learn that it's not Tommy Wiseau giving the audio of the audiobook you told me.
I tell you, though, Greg Sestero does an unbelievable job. He won awards for his audiobook narration.
That's
so
beautiful. Everything about this is just beautiful.
If you enjoy this movie even a little bit, or if just sickly fascinated, I would totally recommend the audiobook. I can't wait to finish it. I wish I could have finished it in time for this podcast, but I'm glad, because I won't spoil the audiobook with too many nuggets that I would be too giddy not to tell all you folks. But I would say that I've done the deep dive this weekend, and I'm going to try to avoid some spoilers until the spoiler section about the biography and about the true story involved here. But I definitely recommend watching The Room, number one. I definitely recommend reading The Disaster Artist. Whatever you may think about the movie The Disaster Artist, both of those stand on their own. Now, during the early part of the decade, the Francos and Seth Rogen, they were turned on to the cult classic. Paul Rudd was the first friend in their group to see it.
That seems proper.
And he kind of spread it like wildfire throughout that whole Judd Apatow group of them, and they all became sickly fascinated. Dave Franco at one point during the promos said, like, I've seen this movie more, like, than any other movie I've ever seen. James Franco's like, I've seen this movie 10 times. I've seen Citizen Kane, or Seth Rogen said this, 3 times.
I mean, and that's the allure of this movie. You have people comparing it to the Ed Wood Plan 9 from Outer Space. It's become one of those so bad it's good movies, and it has film festivals to this day. It has private screenings to this day. It has private screenings that Tommy Wiseau himself shows up to this day.
Yeah, so we're going to have more about that in the spoiler section to give you a fuller picture. But yes, this is an Ed Wood type of movie, a biopic that is very much in the performance genre of the biopic world, I guess the subset. Author Greg Sestero wanted, his dream for his audiobook or for his book was that this would be the fodder for the next Ed Wood. So it's really cool to see how it's come to fruition for Greg Sestero. Again, Greg is Dave Franco. Tommy is James Franco. Now, Seth Rogen's production company, after him and all of his buddies were just obsessed with this movie for like 4 years, they all read the book in 2013 when it came out, and the production company Point Grey Pictures bought the rights to The Disaster Artist in 2014. Franco was set to play Wiseau and was ready to direct, and multiple online interviews have quoted Franco's story about his original conversation with Wiseau, trying to get the rights to Tommy Wiseau's life. Immediately, Tommy asks, who's going to play me?
And if you have a meeting set with Tommy Wiseau, do you do acid before you walk in the door? Or like immediately
after?
Well,
you have to get on the same
you can't.
Level.
There's no drug for that, man.
So Tommy immediately says, I want Johnny Depp to play me. And Franco does the Brandt gesture. And he's on the other line. He's trying not to blow the deal. He's trying not to laugh. But, of course, he does laugh right at Tommy Wiseau over the phone. The conversation goes on. You know, Franco's a smooth actor. You know, he's used to these types of meetings. He butters Tommy up. But Tommy comes back to it. He's like, I have to know who's going to play me. And James Franco still doesn't tell him. And then, luckily, Tommy said, well, I think you could play me.
There you go.
So Tommy... he's always idolized James Dean, as it's apparent in this film.
Very.
Tommy, James and Dave Franco's characters, they idolize James Dean. Tommy and Greg idolize James Dean. James Franco played James Dean in a 2001 TNT original movie that apparently Tommy and Greg watched multiple times, double digits amount of times before they made the Room.
Serendipity of the universe coming together right there.
Another interesting tidbit about the story inception and kind of the pre-production process is that Dave Franco has rejected nearly every attempt by his brother to cast him in one of his movies, whether it's, you know, by referral of a movie that James was acting in or whether James was directing it. Dave did not want to, you know, get by on his brother's coattails.
Yeah, of course. Wants to make his own name. That's right. That's why he kept the last name Franco. Makes total sense.
He took a few referrals from friends of James.
I don't know where I get off taking pot shots at anyone who has any sort of success. I'm sorry, Dave Franco. I do, in fact, love your work.
But yeah, Superbad, Neighbors 2, you know, those are the same group of
definitely
guys.
Definitely has his own
there.
Resume that stands on its own.
But he does. And this was a big victory for James to finally get his brother to work with him. They definitely broke each other's chops about that during the promotion. So, yeah, the cast and crew, the Disaster Artist began filming in December of 2015. Seth Rogen agreed to play the script supervisor and essentially the guy, the character who became the director of most of the room. And I don't know why he brags about this, but the True Life guy brags about the fact that he directed most of the room because Tommy was so nutty and Tommy was acting in it as well. And so Sandy, the character of Sandy, directed that. Ari Grainer, who in my brain I thought was in Glee, was not in Glee, I'm dying up here. She was in.
And she's phenomenal in that show, by the way.
Yeah. She was all the way back to Sopranos, where she launched her career. She plays Juliet Danielle / Lisa in the movie. Josh Hutcherson, a.k.a. PETA.
I mean, let's talk about this cast for a second,
from
right?
The Hunger Games.
There is everybody in Hollywood, and Melanie Griffith is a bit player in this movie.
Melanie Griffith, I mean, Sharon Stone.
Yeah, Sharon Stone. Like, these people just came from all walks of life. And if you're Tommy Wiseau, like, you made this thing that's called, not only caught this cult status, but now you're being portrayed on film in a movie with A-list actor after A-list actor being handled by A-list
actor. The tiniest bit parts, too.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the feeling of pride he must have seeing what his creation has become is out of this world.
Let's say this is the truth. I don't mean to offend anybody, but the pretty factor of the Disaster Artist cast versus the Room cast is not even close.
I mean, follow
the hotness is definitely, you know, on the side of the Disaster Artist, so I think that's, you know, flattering in a way to Tommy Wiseau's addled brain that James Franco, who's a movie star, good looking guy, is playing him. So that probably helped.
Yeah, like you have the A-list of
the
A-list.
He's not going to listen to this.
There's not a lot of A-listers that aren't beautiful people in their own right. Spend hours upon hours with hair and makeup people, professional hair and makeup people.
But you know, that's typical Hollywood. They usually do that.
Yeah,
you watch the, you know, you look at the making of featurettes for any true life story, and it's just some friggin' schmo played by, you know, Tristan and Isolde's whatever.
What the hell are you talking about?
Played by...
Did you just pitch your own film?
Played by some elf from The Lord of the Rings. Some just majestic-looking, you know, creature from another world. You know, these actors, they're flawless people. So
Mike saw Tommy.
I don't like pretty
dream,
people.
So now he's pitching his.
Anyway, Josh Hutcherson, a.k.a. PETA from The Hunger Games, plays Denny, who is a 26-year-old... actor.
I'm just shaking my
in
head.
The room, supposedly playing a 15-year-old.
Wait, 15, 16? I'm 26. Yeah, whatever.
The creepiest character ever in the room, and, you know, Hutcherson does a nice job.
He's like a man-child in the room itself.
It's bizarre. So Jackie Weaver from Animal Kingdom.
There's a pre-coitus pillow fight involving Tommy, Lisa, and this character.
I remember I stood up while I watched The Room when that happened.
Like, you think it's going to lead to a threesome.
It was so obvious that the two of them were saying, like, why this guy is just popping up into their apartment like Kramer, like, you know.
Kramer, that's a great example. Kramer
it
with a bull
weird
haircut.
Enough,
yeah.
Like, this fake haircut. It was even creepier. Like, they go up to have sex. So they give. It's very obvious that they're about to have sex.
We can't get into the directorial decisions made in the room, I don't think.
I'll have a little bit of spoilers, but for now, let's just say that's a teaser. So anyway, back to it third time. Josh Hutcherson, a.k.a. PETA from Hunger Games. Jackie Weaver, a.k.a. Animal Kingdom, Silver Linings Playbook, was Carolyn / Claudette, who's Lisa's mom in the room. In my opinion, the one good actor in that whole movie. Like, she actually is dealing with these god-awful lines, but she's delivering them fairly well and has, you know, making choices and consistent choices that
they
really
also make
help
her the Jiminy Cricket of the Disaster Artist film. They make that character, you know, the, you know. Wish upon a
character.
Star.
So, I mean, she did a nice job, both, you know, the real Claudette and Carolyn, and, you know, Jackie Weaver. Now, like Mike said, it's a who's who, the rest of the cast of comedians, Judd Apatow friends and celebrities, James Franco friends and celebrities. So I won't spoil all of those here, but if they're at the James Franco roast, which is like one of my favorite roasts of all time on Comedy Central.
And it's because you could tell, and it's why this movie, The Disaster Artist, has its charm. You could tell when these guys get along and are just having fun. I'd say. And that's what you could say that about The Roast. You could say that about this movie. You could tell they're in their comfort zone. They don't care if they screw up. They don't care how it's viewed. They're doing what they want to do, and they're having fun. And that's the charm of The Roast, too.
Yeah, it's made by a group of friends who love the source material together, who want to honor it. So, yeah, for some production notes, during production, Franco did not want Tommy Wiseau on his set.
Can't imagine why.
He had a crazy amount of access, this is Franco, to Wiseau materials. Tommy, during the filming of The Room, also documented that entire production by paying a documentary film maker to film hundreds of hours. Franco, apparently, he boasts, watched every single hour of it.
Ooh,
so
really?
There's hundreds of hours of footage about the making of The Room. Franco watched it all.
For those that don't know, Wiseau has fought to keep that documentary from reaching the air. He's not happy with it.
So Greg Sestero used all that footage to write this book.
Right.
Which, I'll be honest, paints Tommy in a very, you know, conflicted, probably at more accurate light. The good and the bad was wide open. That's why Tommy's always said, like, it was 40%, you know, I approve of it 40%. Probably because it, you know, really touches a lot of nerves for him, even though, well, I won't say what their relationship is now yet. But, you know, Tommy also recorded himself throughout that production, pre-production, and he has all these tapes, cassette tapes, of his own, you know, private moments, whether it was him writing the script.
This doesn't surprise me in the least.
Or it was just him in his car. But Tommy Wiseau recorded himself.
I mean, eccentric does not describe this man. Eccentric is what, like, eccentric aspires to be Tommy Wiseau someday, you know? I mean, he's I don't know if he's a genius or if he's a fool, but he's something.
Well, Greg Sestero had access to those cassette tapes from Tommy to write his book and gave them to James Franco to make his movie.
Giving him to a psychiatrist.
Yeah. committed. Anyway, after seeing Wiseau go nuts on camera for hundreds of hours, Franco didn't want the guy on set. However, Wiseau's contract stipulated that he had to act in a scene opposite Franco. So this scene exists in the end credits of the movie. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, you can see Tommy Wiseau pop up in the post-credit scene, which is an appropriately bizarre.
As if all of this isn't meta enough, right? I mean, we have like the scene where the character of Tommy interacts with the real Tommy, and they're both saying how weird each other are, tongue in cheek. Your head blows off.
Leading up to that day, now James Franco totally did not think he was going to include it in the movie because he's like, "All right, I got to honor the contract.
Right.
I got to honor the contract, but there's no way I'm going to put this in my movie. This guy is, you know, bonkers." Now, Tommy Wiseau sends Franco like pictures of a drawn on with a pen, like a normal pen, mustache, fancy mustache and beard.
That sound was me slapping my face and rubbing my eyes.
And says, "Now I'll get a better pen." I think Seth Rogen made the joke. He'll get a better pen when he actually shows up to the set. But don't you worry. But yeah, I mean, they gave him they gave him an actual fake beard and mustache to do that scene. And it's actually, whatever, it's kind of a throwaway scene. So
it's yeah, like Mike said, it's the post-credit scene. It has no impact on the script whatsoever. All right, so all that and a bag of chips was the lead-up to this movie of The Disaster Artist. Like we said, it's a James Franco passion project. I'll give you some of the specs of the film. The Disaster Artist debuted March 12th of this year at South by Southwest, where it instantly gained critical acclaim and word-of-mouth notoriety until its debut wide, which was just a couple weeks ago, December 1st. The writer was Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber. My apologies if I mispronounced either of those names. They were responsible for the screenplay. It was based on the book, as Mike said many times, of Greg Sestero and Tom Bissell.
Yeah, they're the guys from 500 Days of Summer, Spectacular Now. They've written a lot of good stuff.
Not Sestero. No. Just to clear that up. Directed by James Franco, as I said. It's an A24 and Warner Brothers production. A24 having a huge year.
Big year.
Yeah, a big year for them, and we'll get into more of that as we go along. 103 minutes with a $10 million budget. It has an 8.2 IMDb rating on more than 9,000 reviews, which if it keeps that pace up, is going to enter some of the elites for movie making.
Yeah, 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 7.7 out of 10 critic score.
76 meta rating based on Metacritic. It landed two Golden Globe nominees, one for lead actor in a comedy or musical, that would be for James Franco's role as Tommy Wiseau, and one for best picture comedy or musical. Franco also won lead actor awards from the Broadcast Film Critics Association Awards and the Gotham Awards.
Yeah, also nominated for an Indie Spirit and a Satellite Award as well. 15 out of 26 experts on Gold Derby predict Franco to get a Best Actor nomination, and Feinberg Forecast predicts him as well.
I mean, he's every like you said, Satellite, the Washington D.C. Area Film Critics Association Award, the L.A. Film Critics Association Award, all had him nominated for his performance. So he's
in the mix.
Yeah, he's ringing that doorbell. Mike hit on most of the plot points of The Disaster Artist, but let's go over them in a succinct version. Again, non-spoiler. The Disaster Artist is a biographical retelling of the blood, sweat, awkward accents, and myriad of emotions that went into and through the production of one of the most notorious films in the history of Hollywood, Tommy Wiseau's The Room. James Franco plays the eccentric, quote-unquote, New Orleans native, as the film is based on the book written by and the film is told through the lens of Wiseau confidant, and at times only friend in the world, Greg Sestero's. The film is a telling of the ups and downs that went into the production of this film and some of the fallout which followed.
I just listened to a part, literally on a car ride here, about how the inciting incident of this film incited the making of The Room. Basically, the one olive branch of friendship from Dave Franco to James Franco, from Greg Sestero to Tommy Wiseau, started this whole 20-year thing that has become this movie.
And that's what the movie starts at. You have the Greg Sestero characters in acting class. He's sitting there. He's bombing on basically doing a scene in front of his cohorts and his teachers and stuff. And the teacher basically tells him, you've been here for 2 months. You got to open up. He asks Greg to sit down. Can anyone else open up? And we're introduced to the Tommy character played by James Franco, who does a streetcar named Desire on
meth.
I don't know what drug. Yeah. And that's our introduction to Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah. In the audiobook, he describes him as the pirate. And
sure, whatever.
He's wearing
you
like
can describe him as the anything. And I just like, yeah, that's it.
He's wearing like this band leader jacket. It's really bizarre. But yeah, so Mike, going into this movie, what were your expectations of The Disaster Artist?
I'm going to jump to the end in saying this, but I think it fits. My expectations weren't met. I was expecting a great film. I was expecting, you know, an A minus A, especially with all the hype it gained. I don't know if my expectations were too high. And I've just told you this prior to going on air. I've recently been watching a string of biographical films.
Yes.
And I felt this one was a little disconnected. It was at least very different, which could be a good thing, but for me, it kind of tempered my expectations. What about you? What were you feeling going on?
So I also had huge expectations. Now, full disclosure, in the hours going up to my first viewing of The Disaster Artist, I watched The Room. Now, I could have seen Harry and Tonto.
Watch your brother paint for an hour.
Anything. Yeah, I could have watched a Public Access television and thought it was a masterpiece after watching The Room. Now, I will say, I don't think you have to watch The Room to enjoy this movie at
all. I've never seen the whole of The Room, and I enjoyed this movie.
You can just watch the YouTube clips, or there is definitely just a level of enjoyment you can take from watching The Room.
The main scenes of The Room you do need to see are even included in the credits.
Right. I laughed hard, like hard, at least five times.
I was going to
during
say the same
the
thing.
Room.
Oh, during The Room.
During The Room. Oh. I think I laughed harder and bigger during my watching of The Room, which was just completely spine-tinglingly bad. I'm not going to be one of those guys who loves watching bad movies. I never have been.
I can't be. Yeah, I'm the same way.
I just never have been. That's not been my personality. However, I will say this one was so fascinating, and I've been obsessed with it for the last 3 days going into this pod, that I will say I laughed hard, full disclosure, several times, probably more so than what I did at The Disaster Artist.
Let's go in order, a little bit of a structure here. What were your thoughts on as far as the best production value of The Disaster Artist?
So the score, so I guess I want to hit on four things for that. But I mean, I would say the score is pretty upbeat and inspiring. I was a little surprised by that. I figured I was going to walk in and hear the theme for the room, which is just total,
you had,
like
Vietnam flashbacks coming at you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like this nonsense from that movie Anna that we reviewed in 1987
yeah.
pod.
Yeah.
You know, just this, you know, carnival music, this elevator music. It's just so ridiculous. But instead, we get these, you know, positive guitar riffs that make you feel good. And that was a really, you know, that really signified what we were in for. I thought the soundtrack had some fun songs.
Yeah, I had no problem. The sound of this movie was very surprising, I think is a good word for it. I mean, it is in a sense a very uplifting movie, and so it kind of went that route with as far as setting the mood, and that was a success for me.
There's like a mix in this soundtrack of, like, they could have totally went full Night at the Roxbury.
They could have gone dark, too. I mean, yeah. You know, there's dark parts in this movie.
But you could have had a spoof, and one of the things that I think I want to build up to is that I don't think the criticisms that this movie is punching down, I don't think that is accurate. I think that's a predetermined criticism from a lot of people out there that I've watched on YouTube and whatnot. I don't think that Franco and all of his guys were punching down at Wiseau, punching down and just basically being on, you know, the top of Hollywood and then shitting on these little people.
I was actually surprised with how much, not only the seriousness that the role demanded, but I was surprised with how serious everyone took it.
Right.
I think that's actually portrayed. I mean, you know, Seth Rogen isn't in there to make a bunch of jack-off jokes, and Paul Scheer isn't in there to be a human giant, you know, cast off. These guys are playing these roles, and they're bringing seriousness to the movie, and you could see the negative light in which it paints Wiseau as well. So it's not a puff piece. It's not these guys are doing this for fun, and it's not blowing Tommy Wiseau. You know, it's
and the guys,
even-keeled.
The Francos and Rogen were at some Q&A on YouTube where they did mention that the music was part of that process where they couldn't have funny music necessarily. Yes, they have Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch there, Good Vibrations, which might be awesomely bad on that level.
It was also Rhythm of the Night. It was 1988, we're hitting these.
Never Gonna Give You Up.
Right.
But those might just be awesome 90s songs. But you had Rob Bass, Kylie Minogue, Mace, Faith No More. Some of those are still on my
Faith
playlist.
Faith No More gets me hyped, man. I heard that. I was ready to go back into
that
the gym.
That Mace song is still like a favorite of mine. So listen, the music couldn't be, and this is what the guy said, the Franco said, it couldn't be demeaning. It couldn't be funny and make it sound like a spoof or feel like a spoof. On the other hand, the costumes and the makeup were not following this formula, in my opinion. Now, the makeup and the prosthetics that James Franco wore were not that noticeable. So whatever they did a good job. I know his nose is different in real life.
And for having the type of hair that he had throughout the movie, it's so bizarre in that it was so unnoticeable because the hair is so bad. You know, and it's so obviously not James Franco's hair, but it wasn't an obvious wig, even though it's
Tommy Wiseau's hair is pretty bad too.
Yeah,
dude.
I mean, trying to tread lightly, but yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's a weird. You're not Billy Zaning it the whole time. Like,
look,
you,
I mean,
you know,
we're still punching up at Tommy, so.
Yeah, but yeah, it was the production value. You're seeing a Hollywood movie. You're seeing a blockbuster, right?
Right.
I mean, it's a low budget, but it's serious Hollywood class.
Yeah, I mean, the costumes. I still think it's going to make money, by the way, too. Like, it's released wide this week, but it's only to 800 theaters, and it's done, like, $7 million. So it's going okay. Now,
already almost paid back its budget, last check. 9.7, I think.
Nice. So the costumes, they have some ridiculous haircuts. Now, these are almost parodies of 90s haircuts, like the frosted tips that you saw in the Backstreet Boys.
Greg Sestero has frosted tips. A joke is made about that in the movie.
Dave Franco's haircut in this movie is absurd. And I guess it's kind of absurd when you watch The Room, you know, the Dave Franco, Greg Sestero haircut as well. But you have the wig that Denny wears that Josh Hutcherson has. It's like falling off his head at
all
times.
Can I be honest? Like, and this is against me. I didn't realize that was Josh Hutcherson until towards the end of the movie. You know, it hit me like a freight train. I was like, holy crap. That's, you know, that's the Hunger Games boy.
Right. But, and the beard that Dave Franco has is absurdly ridiculous.
And another guy we forgot to mention, Bryan Cranston plays himself in this movie. That beard that Dave Franco has is a big sticking point between Cranston and Sloane
Singh. It's just freaking pubic. That's all it is. So if you have a beard that looks like Dave Franco's in this movie, you know, shave it off enough. And
did we say Alison Brie yet? Did we say she's in this? She's
gorgeous.
Oh, yeah,
Alison Brie, you know, Dave Franco's wife is in this movie.
And if you're a movie buff, you go into this film, you know, and you know who's in it. You know, like we said, it's Seth Rogen, James Franco, all those guys toying
Hannibal
around.
Burris.
Yeah, but it's all people who like each other. It's nice to see them all on screen having their natural chemistry show, even though they're playing roles.
The last thing about Franco's look, I would say, is that lazy eye is something he does by himself. You know, I don't think he did anything there. I don't know. Maybe he used some kind of prosthetic, but that he does that lazy eye himself.
The picture that they use in the movie of Franco's headshot to show the Wiseau poster for the room that was the billboard, uncanny. I mean, it's really, really well done.
It's good. I remember looking at stills of the movie, you know, months ago. Like, is that Dave Franco?
Yeah, I couldn't tell.
James Franco? I couldn't tell.
I could not tell.
So they did a good job. But you watching the movie, it's obviously James Franco. So it works, I thought. Now, I guess we're going to transition into the performances a bit here.
Yeah, let's talk about what you have as your best performance.
James Franco's pretty
easy. I don't think it's, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, he's not only the best performance, it's that he is so far removed from doing what everyone else on this film had to do. I mean, everyone was acting, obviously, but they were playing like Dave Franco even says in an interview when he was during the press junket,
right.
He says his Greg Sestero voice is just his own voice. It's Dave Franco's voice. James Franco needs to go out to, you know, Mars to find Tommy Wiseau and play this character, and he does it.
I think the supporting cast as well did a nice job of servicing the story more than anything else. Like, you got a lot of performers who are used to making people laugh, and they did not really have these showy performances. Like, Seth Rogen probably has the most jokes and punchlines involved. Paul Scheer does a great job of playing one of the crew members.
I can't remember seeing him in a serious role, never mind an angry role. And he was, I mean, you could tell he was pissed when he got pissed.
Yeah, he's a total, you know, goofy character in everything he's done on The League, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
He does a nice job in this. Hannibal Buress and Jason Mantzoukas really don't.
I was waiting for a one-liner from one of them. Like, you know, it was so out of character for them, but they're just normal everyday guys that sell video equipment, and that's what they did in this movie.
You know, Jared Carmichael, who's a great comedian, done HBO specials and whatnot, he goes into, like, this shtick on the rooftop talking to Dave Franco where he's talking smack about Wiseau, and that didn't land for me. I was like, so in a way, like, I don't think these... If the comedians all went off and did like their 30 seconds of shtick or 30 seconds of trying to...
Would have taken you out of the movie.
It might have.
Yeah.
It
might have. I can see that. I mean, you're right. And it's an interesting point and not one that I had thought of. But you're right in that it was... Everyone was acting. Everyone was putting on their performance and putting their best face forward. But there was no... I mean, for as funny as this movie is, it really wasn't any of the big comedy people that were making the laughs.
Zac Efron was kind of funny, but he was just playing angry and, you know.
Yeah, he was over the top.
He was over the top.
He wasn't trying to be funny.
He did a nice job.
Yeah.
What did you think of Dave Franco's performance?
As a hopeful, you know, deer in the headlights up against the world.
I agree.
Him playing 19 was tough to swallow, but he's not 19 for very long in this film.
But he does play over-eager really well.
Yeah, he does. He's a very, very big, very hopeful, very, you know, innocent-looking guy. And he's also got to be the conscience of the movie, because not only is he the surrogate for the audience, because we're seeing everything through his eyes, but he's got to deal with Tommy, and he's got to be kind of the relay between Tommy and everyone else who's a rational human being.
And he's also the surrogate younger brother to this crazy, you know, and it's to his actual real older brother who's a nut, you know, by reputation, obviously.
Yeah, I like Dave Franco a lot in this. I like him in general, but I liked him a lot in this
movie.
Now,
Dave Franco's probably my height. He's probably like 5'8", 5'7".
Right.
And Greg Sestero is like 6'3", 6'4".
X-model.
I mean, he's a prototype for a quarterback,
you know.
He looks like
I like that we both went sports there right off the bat.
Right. So I guess to clarify what we think about James Franco's performances, I'm going to go into some Oscar reel scenes, but it's kind of almost an enveloping thing where most of the James Franco scenes are like
Oscar
reel scenes.
I'll be honest, picking a best scene like we normally do, I don't have a best scene. I have James Franco.
Now, do you think he barely keeps it believable at times? Because upon rewatch, like I said, I saw it twice this weekend. I'm a lunatic.
Somebody had this. I want to say it was the New York Times review. I read a couple professional reviews of this. Somebody said this movie would be unbelievable. It wouldn't be realistic if not for the fact that we know Tommy Wiseau exists.
Right.
So, like, was he playing off the reservation? Yeah, but we don't hang out with Tommy Wiseau, and we can only see what he shows us, and what he shows us is ridiculous enough, right?
I mean, it's not on the level of Johnny Depp playing Hunter S. Thompson, but right. It's of that vein.
Right,
like,
yeah.
It's somebody
it's
so
it's like without
kooky.
The hallucinations showing being shown to us.
Yes. You know? So, I mean, I did get a little sick of the performance upon rewatch. I don't think this is a movie I'm going to revisit 100 times in my life.
Because I don't think you can.
It's an epitome.
Saying,
yeah, it's an epitome of an over-the-top performance, which I usually dig. However, you can get Radio Raheem-ish, and I think the Academy will, against his performance. Even so, Feinberg still predicts him. You know, he's getting a lot of love here during award season. I think all of his emotional scenes are pretty subdued. That was very interesting to watch James Franco's choices. When he does an emotional scene, and I'm not talking about a performance, an emotional scene with just him and his friend, Greg, Dave.
Offset of the room, you
right.
mean, yeah.
He is very subdued. Like, those are not that is not a loud performance from Franco.
And those scenes, let's contextualize a little bit. Those scenes
really
are humanizing Tommy Wiseau. I mean, those are offset of the room, and it's showing his love for Greg, even though it borders on creepy and inappropriate sometimes.
I listened to an interview of the screenwriters, and they said that to structure this movie, we first wrote the friendship scenes, the true to life friendship scenes from the book, from all the video, whatever. Between Tommy and Greg. That was what structured the movie. Then they put all the anecdotes from the making of.
Which is very interesting
stuff.
In itself.
That's
because
fascinating
it is,
to me.
Because it is basically plays like a comedy, a dramedy, if anything.
Right.
Did you get the vibe? Did you think that was an intentional creepy vibe that James portrayed towards Dave, that Tommy had for Greg? Do you think that was a choice? Do you think?
I still think it might be something that's misunderstood by the world or not. I still think, who knows?
Like, to be fair, anything could be, right?
Greg
when it comes
says
to this.
There's a lot of homoerotic undercurrents to Tommy Wiseau and his relationship. I don't know what their status is, but there's still, like, Greg in the audiobook is all over that. The mother is literally getting in Tommy's face saying, you better not have sex with my son.
Oh, Jesus.
In his face, well, you know, time and again during the early portion of that audiobook, that was fascinating to listen to. So it is an undercurrent in the movie.
Right, and it's very prevalent. I mean, it's not hard to say.
Yeah, it's front and center in the book,
certainly
in the
story. They kind of make fun of that, too, in the movie itself, because when they are having the screen test, not the screen test, but the audition to fill the Lisa role, and Ali Grainer's there, and they're having her lick an imaginary ice cream, right?
Right.
And they're saying it's runny, so you gotta lick it on the side. And she's basically giving a phantom blowjob.
Right.
And her character stops and says, listen, is this a legit movie? Because I don't want to do porn. And, like, the Tommy character gets offended and is like, no, I just want to watch you lick an ice cream. It's like, oh, this guy doesn't have any sexual drive at all. You know, it's tongue-in-cheek.
This
kind of
guy's
subconscious
that. Just overflows.
Right.
So even, yeah, I mean, you're right in saying that maybe Tommy is innocent, but maybe he's not innocent. Maybe it's just the subconscious
it
overflows.
It plays
like
both sides of the knife, I think.
It's fascinating how the movie does that. But like I said, it's a strong choice by James Franco to be toned down during the emotional scenes and notched up to 11 when he's actually performing when Tommy Wiseau is performing for other people in the movie.
I'll go as far as to say it's those scenes, the friendship scenes, the Tommy Wiseau lashing out scenes because he's losing Greg to
right.
what he thinks is the woman. I think those are the ones that get Franco his nomination in all these award circuits because it's, again, it humanizes the Tommy Wiseau character, but it shows a multifaceted. It's not just that this is a crazy eccentric human being.
Right.
There's a guy here. There's a human being here with human feelings and emotions that anyone can relate to.
And like I said, the book, and if you watch The Room, I mean, it's just, this is catnip to people who want to research strange psychology here. And
Armchair psychologists for sure.
Armchair psychologists will just die for this whole, you know, triad of, you know, art. Do a deep dive like I did, and you won't be sorry. Now, I guess you mentioned it before, best scene, worst scene. I'm going to save my best scene because it's the finale. I'll save it for the spoilers. What was your best scene?
Like I said, I had a lot of the Franco stuff. I'm going to save actually what is my worst scene, the biggest problem I had, for the same thing, because it's in the same
It's
the same area, so we might want to get to that relatively soon.
My worst scene is just that Franco gets a little annoying at times, almost too unbelievable.
Which one? There's like eight of them in this movie.
Yeah, apparently Tom Franco's in the movie as well. I just looked at IMDb. We took a break. I looked at IMDb, and there's a Tom Franco in there. So I just remember the freaking Bill Hader, you know, riff at the roast of James Franco, and he's making fun of Dave Franco. He's like, that sounds like a fake brother, just Dave Franco. It freaking destroyed me. It's hysterical. Some final thoughts before we go into spoilers, I guess. I would say the finale is, you know, makes a lot of the buildup worthwhile. There's a lot of inside baseball leading up to it.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of The Room, there's a million Easter eggs. And like I said, I'm not a huge fan of The Room or anything. I watched it before I went to see it, but that's it. And there was a lot of little things that I noticed from the movie, the one movie to another.
Yeah, I think we should say if it's a watch or not a watch before we get into the spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that, I mean, for me, this is a watch, if only because it opens up a whole new door of research and questions. I mean, I came home and I immediately started looking up stuff about The Room that I didn't know.
Right.
And the AV Club back in 2011, I think, had people that go to these screenings list out stuff that you could do during the screening that are annual traditions and stuff. And it's like this whole world out there that I didn't know existed.
The audiobook, the deep dive I did while I was snowed in to my, you know, all the YouTube searches and whatnot, that has been way more enjoyable than actually going to the movie and watching the movie twice. I laughed harder the first time. And, you know, upon rewatch, it wasn't a great rewatch, so I knocked it down a few pegs, even though it's still a solid movie. But I was a little upset that it wasn't as good the second, didn't hold up as much for me. I think, like I said, I watched The Room right before. Maybe I overrated it.
Yeah.
I'll overrate anything afterwards, but it is also a watch for me. I think it's a very good movie. I think there's a lot of sincerity, and obviously reading the book, there's a lot of accuracy, at least in terms of the adaptation from book to film. You know, they took some license here and there, but from what I can see, there's a lot of, you know, direct translation, which is really cool to watch great screenwriters at work that are able to accomplish that.
And so, great talent on the screen, too. I mean, these are obviously, Seth Rogen has gone from a guy that's dick jokes and marijuana to he's a legitimate actor. James Franco, same thing, legitimate actor.
I mean, they're making a case. These are longtime, comic actors and comedians. They're making a case for themselves with Oscar night.
All right, so that's going to do it for our spoiler-free section. We're going to sound the alarm here in a minute. If you haven't seen The Room, you don't want us to spoil the disaster. If you haven't seen The Room, if you haven't seen The Disaster Artist,
or The
you
Room,
don't want
I'm going to spoil. Well, I mean, I don't know if I could spoil The Room.
You had to wear 3D glasses, even though the movie's in 2D. If you don't want to hear the end of The Disaster Artist, you want to hear us give everything away, now's the time for you to click off, go check out some of our other Oscar Sprint profiles that are out there, check out our Netflix Year in Review, see what you could watch.
Yeah, come back to us after you
for sure
watch The Disaster Artist leading up to the Oscars. You know you got something, you got another 15 minutes or so where we're going to do a deep dive into this. Come back for us.
And so let's sound the alarm now, because we're going into our spoiler section. Here we go.
Spoiler alert.
Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
All right, now that we got rid of all those losers that haven't seen the movie yet. Nah, I'm just kidding. Welcome to the spoiler section. This is the spoiler for The Disaster Artist. We heard that lovely bells and whistles and that siren that went off before. Again, this is the spoiler section. If you do not want The Disaster Artist spoiled, you have gone too far in your search for this podcast. Go on, head back, listen to the first 45, 50 minutes of this pod, and we'll do it spoiler-free for you. Come back to us here after you've seen the movie and you want us to hear our analysis on it. But for those of you that are in the right place, let's talk about the ending of both The Room and this movie that's up for Oscar contention, The Disaster Artist.
So Tommy Wiseau, I'm going to give you some profile information about Tommy Wiseau. Again, he's the James Franco character in this movie. you have a man that is shrouded in mystery to Greg Sestero throughout the, you know, first few years that he known the guy.
He owns the invisible cloak from Harry Potter, I think.
There have been, you know, private investigators on YouTube who have dug into this man's life. There have been, you know, just interviewers who have tried like all hell over these last 10 years to get some details out of Tommy Wiseau about where he's from.
Any details.
Because those were questions that would completely turn him off for years. And Greg Sestero, the Dave Franco character, was like, he described himself as the perfect friend for Tommy because he knew those questions not to ask Tommy. He knew, and there's kind of a complicated relationship there because Greg is on his, Greg is literally on his ass trying to make it in Hollywood.
He's
not working,
right.
And basically he's staying with Tommy for nothing because Tommy's not even cashing his checks that he sends him to, you know, to live with him. So Greg is a bit, you know.
Yeah, Tommy throughout this movie is a mystery wrapped in an enigma. Nobody knows where he's from. No, he has a bottomless pit of money that everyone takes from. It's rumored that the room alone cost $6 million, and he had to pay everyone on set, the directors, the script operator, you know, and he pays them. Their check's always clear. Nobody knows where he gets the money from. He's just the guy that showed up.
There are a couple theories on it. Now, I don't know if these are the main theories or prevailing theories. I haven't gotten to the point in the audiobook where they're going to reveal that. Like I said, I'm 2/3 of the way in, and he's kind of teased that he's going to reveal that. So if you really want to hear Greg Sestero's opinion, I totally recommend that audiobook. But online, there is a theory that Tommy Wiseau, whose last name, if you spell it with an O instead of a W, means bird in French. Tommy apparently sold bird toys underneath the Eiffel Tower, that tourist trap area. Sold bird toys, trinkets that were, you know, just kites and all this whatever stuff.
What the fuck are you talking
underneath
about?
Underneath the Eiffel Tower. Now, he did that. He sold to tourists in France. He was originally born in Poland.
You could have told me he was actually Larry Bird, and
now,
I believe you.
There's a lot of evidence for this online. I don't know how credible the sources are, but Tommy apparently sold those things. He moved into selling yo-yos. Okay,
so as one does.
Now, this, a lot of people have mentioned the fact that was a yo-yo salesman through the 80s or 90s. He comes to America.
I feel like I'm in the episode of The X-Files right now.
Yeah, and he basically camps out in another big tourist area of San Francisco. He's selling his trinkets. I guess he's making loads of money because he still has, you
know, bird trinkets.
He still has the bird toys going.
Non sequitur, are there any sponsors out there for us?
The bird toys are selling like hotcakes, and he's now outsourcing the bird toys that are, they're selling all over the world.
Because
again,
when you have a
his
bird
name
empire.
Is Tommy Bird. He's nicknamed the Birdman. And yes.
Why would he hide this? Like, this is the information that's going to bring him down.
Now, this could
make
him
weird.
This could be total bullshit his last name means bird. I don't know. I'm leaving the door open for
we'll
the
try to drop
audiobook
Charlie
to change my mind.
Being
I'm almost
a master in bird law.
But I'm glad that because this speculation is fascinating to me. So he eventually owns his own clothing company. He sells jeans.
Naturally.
He owns the building. This is on the records that they showed me on the YouTube video. I don't know if this guy is bullshit or not.
You went too deep, man.
But
you went too deep.
He owns this building that's probably worth $10 million in San Francisco. So he had a business running out of it for years, whatever clothing company it was, and he was selling jeans. And he still sells on the Room website, on the TommyWiseau.com.
Which,
still
if you want
sells,
a trip, go on the Room website.
Yeah, he still sells underwear and T-shirts
and
all this kind of stuff there.
And it has not, it's been updated, but he doesn't erase when it's previously updated. So he's got stuff on there saying he's coming to your city in July of 2016. You know, like.
So this dude somehow becomes rich. Now, I don't know, who knows how. He's probably in his 40s, that Sestero thought he was in his 40s.
During the movie, he always tells Greg he's the same age as him, which is an
Greg
obvious lie.
Greg was 20 and, you know, looked 19.
Right.
You know, he didn't look old at all. So, yeah, Tommy and the Room it's just a fascinating story in its own right. So I'm going to give you a little background of how The Room caught fire. And this is the very beginning of the audiobook. So I'm kind of teasing the audiobook. I'm not really spoiling the audiobook for you. Now, Greg mentions that Tommy bought, like he said, he bought the billboard for 5 years. He also paid for the movie to be screened at that at a local theater for 5 years, once a month, for 5 years. Now, film students at LA Film Schools, the mecca of film schools, two of them went to that movie theater one day and they looked at this humongous sign for no refunds. They asked the guy who ran the movie theater why this sign, this big nasty sign for no refunds. And the guy just kind of looked at the Room poster it was playing that week and it like didn't answer. So the kids were like fascinated. So they looked up the reviews of The Room.
I have no idea where he's going with this, people.
They looked up the reviews of The Room, right? And one of the reviews of The Room said, "This watching this movie is like getting stabbed in the face." So the kids were in. These film students were in. They went and saw the movie. They started bringing all of their friends. And he names these kids in the book. They became the number one fans of this movie. All their film school friends. This thing like mushroom clouds throughout Hollywood. Next thing you know, L.A., this is just L.A. right now, L.A. is turning out for The Room once a month in with good crowds. They start doing, like, they start inventing all of the little rituals. They'll show up in tuxedos. They'll throw the football around during the movie when the characters are throwing the football around. There are a trio of framed photographs on one of the mantles or the tables in The Room. They're basically in that one room, right? The whole movie. There's three photographs of spoons, framed photographs of spoons. Every time somebody sees those in the audience, they throw plastic spoons at the screen. Every time San Francisco is shown, they're like the establishing shots are shown. They're singing the Full House theme song.
So there's everywhere you look. I mean, this is all, and this is all, you know, it's not an old wives' tale. This is all in the AV Club article written by people that go to these annual screenings in LA.
So an Entertainment Weekly scribe, one of the critics there, he is brought in to see this movie by a friend of his and is blown away by the audience. And I don't know if it was him or another critic, but somebody said at this time before it kind of spread nationwide, he said that watching The Room was the best, the most fun theatrical experience of my life. And these are full-time film people.
Right.
So there's an article written in Entertainment Weekly.
That's so funny.
It's covered next by CNN, a lot, and Time Magazine. Next thing you know, every midnight theater in the country, at every big city, is playing The Room as a best bad movie, and now you have a cult following. It is spread around the world.
Guess how I guessed all those theaters? They got to buy the rights.
Tommy Wiseau, it's estimated by James Franco. I don't know if this is right, but James Franco's estimated he's making about $500,000 a year right now, and who knows if that balloons up.
God bless America.
So Tommy Wiseau allegedly spent $7 million on The Room.
At the end of the credits, that says they estimate $6 million, but that's, yeah, that's the
ballpark. He bought the equipment, which was never done.
Also referenced in the movie. Yeah, it's unbelievable. So, he didn't just buy one set of equipment.
He bought HD cameras and he bought film cameras, which was completely never done. The lighting, as the guy's reference, was totally different. So anyway, that's just a couple nuggets about the backstory of The Room. Just completely fascinating story around the story, which is perhaps this movie's best feature. We were both saying that this is kind of a B+ for us, correct?
Yeah, I mean, without going too deep into the grade, but I guess we'll give them away now in the spoiler section. I was expecting, you know, an A-, like I said at the top. I settled in at like an 86, 87. I guess I'd go an 87 B+ if I got to get pushed to a grade. For Franco's performance alone, it's definitely worth it. To see all the people that make you laugh so regularly play it so straight-laced, and to see, you know, Paul Scheer flip out, like I said, there's good in this movie. There's a story problem that I had that we'll get to, but what'd you have for your grade?
Yeah, I think I'm a tick above that at an 88 right now. Kind of it's on the level of the Meyerowitz stories for me.
That's so fair, yeah.
It's underneath the Big Sick. I think I
was higher on the Big Sick than most.
Well, I have that as an 89, so I was just like a comedy.
One.
So that's where it kind of fits for me. I really admire the spirit of this movie because, like I said, I think
the ball's on Franco, too, to go after the rights and then play it as true to form and true to life as the movie, the book presents it. I mean, good for him.
It dances the dance of poking fun at this guy without tearing this guy up. And there's a lot of flattery.
Which is the problem I have with the last scene, but again, we'll get there.
Well, still, there's a lot of flattery. Now, I have the finale as my best scene, so maybe we have a debate.
So go into that first, the best scene. What aspect of the finale? So let me set it up first. The last scene, the movie, obviously, like we said, is the whole build-up to the production of The Room. The final scene is Tommy puts together this big opening night at this big Hollywood. It's a real Hollywood premiere. He buys a spotlight and a red carpet for all the crew, casting crew to come into. So they have the opening night of The Room. They get a packed theater, which is more packed than they expected it to be, with onlookers seeing this film for the first time. The casting crew is there in the front rows. Tommy wants it to be a serious movie. Everyone was involved in a serious movie, but as the film shows itself, the reactions get more and more comical. People are uproariously laughing by the end of this, throwing things at the screen and having the times of their lives, which pisses Tommy off. He leaves the theater before Greg has to calm him down and say, look, you're giving all these moviegoers this wonderful experience. Listen to them laugh. Hitchcock never got a reaction like this to any of his movies, with Tommy finally embraces the irony of it all and goes into the spotlight at the end of the movie as this master of comedy, this creator, this auteur of this beloved film.
So
go ahead.
The structure of that sequence and what you feel as you're watching that sequence in many ways, and this is something I've realized the last day or so after seeing it again, is the experience you have while watching The Room. The characters are going through the same experience that I had in that gruesome hour and 40 minutes or whatever that was watching The Room, where I wanted to turn it off like 10 times, even though I was enjoying parts of it. That's what you have during that last sequence, because the room starts off. Number one, the characters assassinate themselves in the most absurd ways possible. Like, you have a guy telling a story about this woman who, this ex-girlfriend who sleeps
around.
There
has never been more face-rubbing between Mike and I in the review of any movie than there has been in this one, by the way. We just can't wrap our minds about it. I'm sorry. Keep going.
They mention it in The Disaster Artist. They show it. They show the scenes of them filming it, and actually Seth Rogen directing it. But there's a scene where Tommy Wiseau laughs at a story of domestic violence. And he's and
painfully
Seth
awkward.
Rogen's like, it's not a funny story. It's a horrible story. And
the story
the
that you wrote.
Factor, and it's just so absurd. And he's such a jerk that scene is just in the early part of this movie. So you're just like, what? WTF?
The hell
There's
is
also
going on?
Two sex scenes. There really three sex scenes in the first 30 minutes of this movie that go for 5 minutes apiece. The second sex scene reuses scenes from the first sex scene. It's just...
And in the movie, the Wiseau character is like, I have to show my ass. That's what gets people in the
seats. It's like he wanted to showcase the full song in the soundtrack, the R&B song that he uses, he enjoys so much. He has to do this whole
song. It's almost a parody of that episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where Dennis is pitching his movie idea that he wants to show full penetration. It's like, back to the lab. Penetration, lab, penetration.
And one of the better laughs in the room is when Wiseau, with thankfully, unlike the movie The Disaster Artist, with the sheet over his butt, but he is just so high up.
Yes, which is commented on
humping,
by Seth Rogen.
He's humping her belly.
It's as if he's having sex with Lisa's belly button.
Which
they do in The Disaster Artist.
Which is
Rogen
revealing about Tommy, that Tommy doesn't want to, he's trying to help the, and his bizarre way. He's trying to be,
Yeah, but see, in The Disaster
polite to
in
the
disaster
actress.
Artist, where that scene happens, where he's having sex with her belly button, you know, for lack of a better term, it's presented because he's doing that because he's pissed off. He's pissed off because Greg has just told him he's moving out. So that's not, he's not showing passion to the Allie, the Lisa character.
In my
moment.
Mind, just.
In your mind, you may have had a different interpretation.
I think Tommy is not, he's trying not to have almost sex with her. He's trying not to, you know, bump uglies there. That's what I think he's doing. I don't know.
It's a very, I mean, he's wildly out of control in that scene. He makes fun of Lisa for having a blemish on her shoulder. Yeah.
But that's Tommy's whole persona. Like, he does something awful and then he immediately tries to do something nice for that person right afterwards, which is what Greg always finds as a redeeming quality in Tommy. Like, he's extremely generous. He's a funny guy. He helps Greg out every step he can. And then he does something terrible to him.
I didn't find a redeeming quality in that scene. I think he does more good things later on, but in that scene, I just saw malice.
Yeah, but this is a guy who shows a lot of malice. That's why the book is more of a rounded picture,
right? And they,
of his
character. I thought they did. I obviously didn't read the book, but I thought they showed that.
They get there. They get there, but that's one of the scenes where, you know, as good as
it's he, interesting you have that take. I wouldn't have had that take, but that's why he was doing it.
I don't know.
Who knows? It's Tommy Wiseau, but
maybe he's just gay.
Trying to have sex with her belly button.
Maybe he's gay or he's celibate.
And props to Franco going basically balls out on the set of The Disaster Artist in front of all his friends. You see all of James Franco.
Well that. Yeah. So that anyway, building back up to my Room versus Disaster Artist comparison there, the finale kind of takes you through these sex scenes and there's some jokes, but the early portion of the finale is cringeworthy, right? The scenes in the Disaster Artist. So it's hard to get through, but then, you know, watching the people go nuts for it, you know, against it in a way, and watching how Dave/Greg rationalizes the movie for Tommy, that seems really genuine and true, and it was funny. It was funny watching that crowd laugh at some of the things that made me just die.
So the redemption story at the very end is your best scene.
The redemption, yeah, I thought they pulled that off. And that's like funny. I said, it's just the parallels worked like gangbusters for me.
Because that is my worst scene. It's the exact same idea, but my take is differently. Like I said, in watching all these biofilms, I mean, you're dealing with a genius that knows how smart they are overcoming an obstacle and basically having a redemption story, right? But their redemption story in these ways are stories that they're in on. It's a triumph in one way or another. Whether you're talking about A Beautiful Mind or talking about Steve Jobs, they get what they're going after. Tommy is portrayed in this.
I would cut you off for a second there, because usually what's the smoking gun in those stories? Definitely Steve Jobs, definitely A Beautiful Mind. The smoking gun, what changes the character's arc is what he takes for granted, either in his support system with his family or what he takes for granted about himself, about just some general attribute of himself that comes in and solves his problem.
I'm not,
so the quote
right,
unquote
I,
overall
I
genius.
Redemption.
But that's the redemption is not found with his, you know, with I
my
mean, it's
point
found
is
with,
those people are in on the joke of their lives, of their successes, of what they're going after. Tommy, in this way, I mean, I guess it was more of a biopic about an ordinary man, so maybe he shouldn't have been in on the joke, but he's not in on the joke.
That's my point, though.
I know it is, and that's why I'm saying there's such a dichotomy here. He's reluctant, like, he only embraces the joke after he realizes he can't do any better.
But it's the same for Steve Jobs, and it's definitely the same with A Beautiful Mind. They don't know what they don't know, and once they realize that, that's the epiphany at the end, especially of Steve Jobs. Like, I don't want to spoil Steve Jobs.
But they're able to get what they're going after. Social Network, same thing. They're able to grasp finally what their intent was.
Social Network is like a tragic realization, I think, by him. Like he realizes what he's trying to get the whole time, and it's just something so simple and so fundamental for everybody. I mean, if you've seen The Social Network, you know what I mean.
But I feel like Tommy isn't in on the joke. I don't know if he's ever in on the joke. And maybe that's the charm of Tommy Wiseau. But to me, it kind of missed the mark in that he was chasing fame and success to spite everyone else. But he only got it because everyone else was laughing at him. So, he chose to think they were laughing with him after the fact. which I kind of have a problem with.
That's a complicated setup. Now, there's definitely nuances involved there. Perhaps my overall look at this movie has made those distinctions for me, especially upon rewatch of this movie, because Tommy is much smarter. And he's an entrepreneurial genius if those that backstory is true.
If it's true, which we have no indication that it is in the movie.
In the movie, we know he's a multimillionaire.
But it could come from parents. It could come from a lawsuit. Inherited. Yeah.
We don't know. But still, like, listening to this guy, there's a lot of intelligence for Greg. There's a lot of intelligence for Tommy. I don't think it's accidental that these guys, the bottom line is they don't know anything about making movies. Like, that is totally new and foreign to them. And that's why, you know, you can look at The Room as something of what not to do for, you know, filmmakers, which is perfect for why the film students grabbed onto this movie first and foremost, made it a cult classic. But you can also kind of look at it. I mean, when I first watched this, I was like, this is some just wet dream, The Room, for some misogynistic 1980s homeschool student who's 13 years old and undersexed. Like, this is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
45-year-old man allegedly from New Orleans.
This is the subconscious of somebody that is completely stunted and their development is thoroughly arrested and they're just totally paranoid. So there's like a genius in how honest it is, in a way, but
yeah, I would agree with
that. It is totally effed up in the themes of the movie. Now, Tommy, in all of the interviews, in many ways, realizes a lot of this, and he has changed his answers over the years. It's fascinating to watch how he's changed
those answers.
Which
makes me even more, I mean, and I've seen those, and I agree. I've seen a lot of the explanations he has. But
James calls him out on it. Yeah,
it reaffirms to me that he's not in on the joke still. He wants to be famous and revered as a filmmaker, but he's not willing to say, laugh at me, laugh at what I did.
It's weird because it's like there's this dichotomy of him getting off on the fame. But in a way, James Franco shows that with how Tommy's character, the character of Tommy, deals with the finale and the post-movie applause in that scene. Because he goes up there and he's like, and he totally lies. So, I mean, this guy's a pathological liar in any story about him that you could you dig up, because Tommy goes up on the stage and he goes, I'm so glad you enjoyed my comedic movie.
Right, and that's the whole problem I have with it, is that he sells himself out because he just...
But that's the truth of this guy's character by every, you know, record.
I also think it's very interesting that you have that sort of take where you're defending that's being part of his personality after having listened to the source material.
This guy... Even if
and I have it, and I have the opposite
what's
viewpoint.
The truth is that this guy is delusional from the jump, right?
Yeah.
Tommy Wiseau is delusional in the movie, in the book, whatever. This is a delusional person. This is a person who's so... I mean, and in a way, it's heartwarming to watch a delusional person, somebody who's just a big dreamer, a delusional human being in every sense of the word, need a friend, and that friend is starting to bring him back to Earth, even though he can't come all the way back to Earth. He's on Tommy's planet, like they say in the movie. So that's kind of a heartwarming thing to watch.
But
this
if you're
level
such an out there character, and if he is that disturbed, and if you are such an out there character, if you are such a ludicrous human being, why is he so willing to sell out on his ideal?
Well,
I mean, he compares himself to James Dean. He compares himself to Hitchcock.
Because he still gets
Tennessee
the results.
Williams.
And it says a lot about Hollywood. The results that in the movie James Franco's character wants, that he states, so you state the theme at the beginning, James Franco's character states, we want to be big stars. We want to be the greatest. Now, we have to be, we think, because there's always a interpretation of what it will take to get what the character wants.
Do you agree
wants,
that
right?
he's not in on the joke?
I would agree with
Still?
You there. Yeah, I would agree. Well, okay. At the same time, there's also a lot of...
Do you think he knows what the joke is?
There's a realization of the fact that people are laughing at him at the end of this movie and in Tommy Wiseau's life.
So you think he knows what the joke is?
He knows. In a way, he knows what the joke is. At the time after the premiere, I think you might be right. I don't think his character knew necessarily.
So it could be a subjectivity
He was somewhat
thing.
Aware.
Yeah, yeah.
He was somewhat aware.
It sounds like we're saying the same thing. We just have different appreciation of it.
Right, I'm okay with that fact. If you're not okay with, but like you said, you're nitpicking it for a very, you know.
I mean, it's a BB plus movie. Not at all. Not by any stretch.
But
it's
these are fascinating people.
Fascinating people. Fascinating source material, from what you've told me for sure, and fascinating in execution.
I mean, listen, I'm pubbing Audible again. I'm going to send you this book
because
it's
that
free.
Before.
No, I was going to send you like a 2-hour book about podcasting. That would have been worthless to you, especially after all this, you know.
Sunk costs.
But all this new gear we bought, so whatever. We're down. We're too far.
Yeah, we're in the rabbit hole.
I'll send you this, and you'll just enjoy listening to it.
Yeah, it is something I want to read now, for sure.
Yeah.
So that's going to be the spoiler section. That's The Disaster Artist in a nutshell, both spoiler-free and chock-full of spoilers. James Franco, you're probably going to see his name come Oscar time if the recent awards are any indication. So I would keep an eye out for this one. I would definitely go see it if you want to be up to date on your Oscars. This was our first Oscar Sprint episode. It's our first profile of one of the contenders. Like we said, we're going to hopefully do a couple of these a week at least, and we're going to get them all out, have a self-contained episode for each movie, and attack it in this way, give you spoilers, give you non-spoilers, get it out there so you can consume it, and you could be as prepared as anyone for the Academy Awards.
We got episodes coming out about the critics, the L.A., New York Critics' Choice Awards. So go back and listen to our Hollywood hot takes about that.
And our Golden
if you're
Globes
listening kind of
yep.
in time. We got a Golden Globes episode that just came out. So listen to that, baby. We got a Netflix year in review, and we got a summer year in review. So there's a lot of 2017 goodness from the Mike, and Oscar programming list that you guys can reference. Again, tell your friends about us, please. You know, we're trying to make these episodes more accessible to everybody. Hopefully there's a big slate of things you can click on down the line whenever you start to enjoy us. You can have just a big list of episodes to go on the elliptical, John Snow style, 7 days in hell, Kit Harington style, for your elliptical training montage there. So just, put us on the earbuds and go nuts.
This is our sweet spot, guys. We want to be Oscar retrospectives, and for the Oscar sprint, we're going to be doing present day stuff, because we want you to, you know, if you can get emotionally attached to a very sickening degree to a film in a category like we will be, no doubt, that then we've achieved our goal for Academy Night. But until then,
reality sucks, man.
That's right.
Keep watching movies with us.
We say it every time. You want to reach out to us, we are Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram. We are MMO_pod on Twitter. We are Mike and Oscar at Gmail. Please reach out to us.
Talk to us, man. We'll read your stuff on the air when we can. And we'll have fun chatting with you.
Let's do it. Run us to your marks, like you said, and we're off.
Oscar Sprint, man. Bang. Let's do it.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you later.